And probably, the sweet thought, what made it so frightening for them is that they believed Dawn could get their husbands. They'd notice how men looked at her and how attentive they were to her wherever she went. He noticed it himself, but never worried, not about a wife as proper as Dawn, who'd been brought up as strictly as she was. But all of this so rankled Dawn that first she gave up going to the beach club in a bathing suit, any bathing suit. Then, much as she loved the surf, she gave up going to the beach club at all, and whenever she wanted to swim, drove the 4 miles down to Avon, where as a child she used to vacation with her family for a week in the summertime. On the beach at Avon, she was just a simple, petite Irish girl with her hair pulled back about whom nobody cared one way or another. She went to Avon to get away from her beauty, but Dawn couldn't get away from it any more than she could openly flaunt it. You have to enjoy power, have a certain ruthlessness, to accept the beauty and not mourn the fact that it overshadows everything else. As with any exaggerated trait that sets you apart and makes you exceptional, and enviable, and hateable, to accept your beauty, to accept its effect on others, to play with it, to make the best of it, you're well advised to develop a sense of humor. Dawn was not a stick. She had spirit and she had spunk and she could be cutting in a very humorous way, but that wasn't quite the inward humor it took to do the job and make her free. Only after she was married and no longer a virgin did she discover the place where it was okay for her to be as beautiful as she was, and that place, to the profit of both husband and wife, was with the Swede in bed. They used to call Avon the Irish Riviera. The Jews without much money went to Bradley Beach, and the Irish without much money went next door to Avon, a seaside town all of 10 blocks long. The swell Irish, who had the money, the judges, the builders, the fancy surgeons, went to Spring Lake, beyond the imposing manorial gates just south of Belmar, another resort town, which was more or less a mixture of everybody. Dawn used to get taken to stay in Spring Lake by her mother's sister, Peg, who'd married Ned Mahoney, a lawyer from Jersey City. If you were an Irish lawyer in that town, her father told her, and you played ball with City Hall, Maya, I am the law, Haig, took care of you. Since Uncle Ned, a smooth talker, a golfer, and good-looking, had been on the Hudson County gravy train from the day he graduated John Marshall and signed on across the street with a powerful firm right there in Journal Square, and since he seemed to love pretty Mary Dawn best of all his nieces and nephews, every summer, after the child had spent her week in the Avon rooming house with her mother and father and Danny, she went on by herself to spend the next week with Ned and Peg and all the Mahoney kids at the huge old Essex and Sussex Hotel right on the oceanfront at Spring Lake, where every morning in the airy dining room overlooking the sea, she ate French toast with Vermont maple syrup. The starched white napkin that covered her lap was big enough to wrap around her waist like a sarong, and the sparkling silverware weighed a ton. On Sunday, they all went together to St. Catherine's, the most gorgeous church the little girl had ever seen. You got there by crossing a bridge, the loveliest bridge she had ever seen, narrow and humpbacked and made of wood, that spanned the lake back of the hotel. Sometimes, when she was unhappy at the swim club, she'd drive beyond Avon into Spring Lake and remember how Spring Lake used to materialize out of nowhere every summer. Magically full-blown, Mary Dawn's Brigadoon. She remembered how she dreamed of getting married in St. Catherine's, of being a bride there in a white dress, marrying a rich lawyer like her Uncle Ned, and living in one of those grand summer houses whose big verandas overlooked the lake and the bridges and the dome of the church, while only minutes from the booming Atlantic. She could have done it, too. Could have had it just by snapping her fingers. But her choice was to fall in love with and marry Seymour Lavove of Newark, instead of any one of those dozens and dozens of smitten Catholic boys she met through her Mahoney cousins, the smart, rowdy boys from Holy Cross and Boston College, and so her life was not in Spring Lake, but down in Deal and up in Old Rimrock with Mr. Lavove. Well, that's the way it happened, her mother would say sadly to whoever would listen. Could have had a wonderful life there just like Peg's, better than Peg's. St. Catherine's and St. Margaret's are there. St. Catherine's is right by the lake. They're beautiful buildings, just beautiful. But Mary Dawn's the rebel in the family, always was, always did just what she wanted, and from the time she marched off to be in that contest, fitting in like everybody else is apparently not something she wanted. Dawn went to Avon strictly to swim. She still hated lying on the beach to take the sun, still resented having been made to expose her fair skin to the sun every day by the New Jersey pageant people. On the runway, they told her, her white swimsuit would look striking against a deep tan. As a young mother, she tried to get as far as she could from everything that marked her as a former whatever, and that aroused insane contempt in other women and made her feel unhappy and like a freak. She even gave away to charity all the clothes the pageant director, who had his own idea of what kind of girl should be presented by New Jersey to the Miss America judges, had picked out for her at the designers' showrooms in New York during Dawn's day-long buying trip for Atlantic City. The Swede thought she looked great in those gowns, and he hated to see them go, but at least, at his urging, she kept the state crown so that someday she could show it to their grandchildren. And then, after Mary started at nursery school, Dawn set out to prove to the world of women, for neither the first time nor the last, that she was impressive for something more than what she looked like. She decided to raise cattle. That idea, too, went back to her childhood, way back to her grandfather, her mother's father, who as a 20-year-old from County Kerry, came to the port in the 1880s, married, settled in South Elizabeth, close to St. Mary's, and proceeded to father 11 children. His living he earned at first as a hand on the docks, but he bought a couple of cows to provide milk for the family, wound up selling the surplus to the big shots on West Jersey Street. The Moores, for more paint, Admiral Bull Halsey's family, Nicholas Murray Butler, the Nobel Prize winner, and soon became one of the first independent milkmen in Elizabeth. He had about 30 cows on Murray Street, and though he didn't own much property, it didn't matter. In those days, you could let them graze anywhere. All his sons went into the business and stayed in it until after the war, when the big supermarkets came along and knocked out the little man. Dawn's father, Jim Dwyer, had worked for her mother's family, and that was how Dawn's parents had met. When he was still only a kid, before refrigeration, Jim Dwyer used to go out on the milk truck at 12 o'clock at night and stay out till morning delivering milk off the back of the truck. But he hated it, too tough a life. The heck with that, he finally said, and took up plumbing. Dawn, as a small child, loved to visit the cows, and when she was about 6 or 7, she was taught by one of her cousins how to milk them. And that thrill, squirting the milk out of those udders, the animals just standing there eating hay and letting her tug to her heart's content, she never forgot. With beef cattle, however, she wouldn't need the manpower to milk, and she could run the operation almost entirely by herself. The Simmental, which made a lot of milk but was a beef animal as well, still weren't a registered breed in the United States at that time, so she could get in on the ground floor. Crossbreeding, Simmental to Polled Hereford, was what interested her. The genetic vigor, the hybrid vigor, the sheer growth that results from crossbreeding. She studied the books, took the magazines, the catalogs started coming in the mail, and at night she would call him over to where she was paging through a catalog and say, "Isn't that a good-looking heifer? Have to go out and take a look at her." Pretty soon they were traveling together to shows and sales. She loved the auctions. "This reminds me just a little too much," she whispered to the Swede, "of Atlantic City. It's the Miss America pageant for cows." She wore a tag identifying herself, Dawn Lavove, Arcady Breeders, which was the name of her company, taken from their old Rimrock address, Box 62, Arcady Hill Road, and found it very hard to resist buying a nice cow. A cow or a bull would be led into the ring and paraded around, and the show sponsors would give the background of the animal, the sire and the dam, and what they did, what the potential was, and then the people would bid. And though Dawn bought carefully, her pleasure, just in raising her hand and topping the previous bid, was serious pleasure. Much as he wanted more children, not more cows, he had to admit that she was never so fascinating to him, not even when he first saw her at Uppsala, as in those moments at the auction when her beauty came enticingly cloaked in the excitement of bidding and buying. Before Count arrived, the champion bull she bought at birth for $10,000, which her husband, who was 100% behind her, still had to tell her was an awful lot of money, his accountant would look at the figures for Arcady Breeders at the end of each year and tell the Swede, This is ridiculous. You can't go on this way. But they really couldn't take a beating, as long as it was mostly her own time she put into it. And so he told the accountant, "Don't worry, she'll make some money." He wouldn't have dreamed of stopping her, even if eventually she didn't make a cent, because as he said to himself when he watched her and the dog out with the herd, these are her friends. She worked like hell, all by herself, keeping track of the calving, getting the calves drinking out of a plastic bottle with a nipple if they didn't get the idea of sucking, tending to the mothers feeding before she put them back in the herd. For the fencing, she had to hire a man, but she was out there with him baling the hay, the 1,800, 2,000 bales that saw them through the winter. And when Count was on in years and got lost one winter day, she was heroic in hunting him down. For 3 days, combed the woods for him before she found him, where he had got himself onto a little island out in the swamp. Getting him back to the barn was ghastly. Dawn weighed 103 pounds and was 5 feet 2 inches tall. The Count weighed about 2,500 pounds, a very long, very beautiful animal with big brown spots around either eye, sire of the most sought-after calves. Dawn kept all the bull calves, breeding for other cattle owners who would keep these bulls in their herds. The heifers she didn't sell often, but when she did, people wanted them. Count's progeny won year after year at the national shows, and the investment returned itself many times over. But then Count got stranded out in the swamp because he had thrown his stifle out. It was icy, and he must have got his foot caught in a hole between roots. And when he saw that to get off this little island, he had to get through wet mud, he just quit. And it was 3 days before Dawn could find him anywhere. Then, with the dog and Mary, she went out with a halter and tried to get him back, but he hurt too much and didn't want to get up. So they came back later with some pills, loaded him up with cortisone and different things, and sat there with him for another few hours in the rain, and then they tried again to move him. They had to get him through roots and stones and deep muck, and he'd walk a bit and stop, walk a bit and stop, and the dog got behind him and she'd bark, and so he'd walk another couple of steps. And that was the way it went for hours. They had him on a rope, and he'd take his head, this great big head, all curly with those beautiful eyes, and he'd pull the rope and just swing the two of them, Dawn and Mary together, boom. So then they'd get themselves up and start all over again. They had some grain, and he'd eat a little, and then he'd come a little farther, but altogether it took 4 hours to get him out of the woods. Ordinarily, he led very well, but he hurt so that they had to get him home almost piece by piece. Seeing his petite wife, a woman who could, if she wanted to, have been just a pretty face, and his small daughter drenched and covered with mud when they emerged with the bull on the rain-soaked field back of the barn, was something the Swede never forgot. "This is right," he thought. "She's happy we have Mary, and that's enough." He wasn't a religious man, but at that moment he offered up thanks, saying aloud, "Something is shining down on me." To get the bull to the barn took Dawn and Mary nearly another hour, and there he just lay down in the hay for 4 days. They got the vet, and the vet said, "You're not going to get him any better. I can make him more comfortable. That's all I can do for you." Dawn brought him water to drink and buckets and food to eat, and one day, as Mary used to tell the story to whoever came to the house, he decided, "Hey, I'm all right." And he got up, and he wandered out, and he took it easy, and that's when he fell in love with the old mare, and they became inseparable. The day they had to ship Count, send him to the butcher, Dawn was in tears and kept saying, "I can't do this." And he kept saying, "You've got to do this." And so they did it. Magically, Mary's word, the night before Count left, he bred a perfect little heifer, his parting shot. She got the brown spots around the eyes. He threw brown eyes all around him. But after that, though the bulls were well bred, never again was there an animal to compare with the Count. So, did it matter finally that she told people she hated the house? He was now far and away the stronger partner. She was now far and away the weaker. He was the fortunate, doubtlessly undeserving recipient of so much. What the hell, to whatever demand she made on him, he acceded. If he could bear something and Dawn couldn't, he didn't understand how he could do anything but accede. That was the only way the Swede knew for a man to go about being a man, especially one as lucky as himself. From the very beginning, it had been a far greater strain for him to bear her disappointments than to bear his own. Her disappointments seemed to dangerously rob him of himself. Once he had absorbed her disappointments, it became impossible for him to do nothing about them. Half measures wouldn't suffice. His effort to arrive at what she wanted always had to be wholehearted. Never was he free of his quiet wholeheartedness. Not even when everything was on top of him, not even when giving everyone what they needed from him at the factory, and everyone what they needed from him at home, dealing promptly with the supplier's screw-ups, with the union's exactions, with the buyer's complaints, contending with an uncertain marketplace and all the overseas headaches, attending on demand to the importuning of a stuttering child, an independent-minded wife, a putatively retired, easily riled-up father, did it occur to him that this relentlessly impersonal use of himself might one day wear him down? He didn't think like that any more than the ground under his feet thought like that. He seemed never to understand, or, even in a moment of fatigue, to admit that his limitations were not entirely loathsome, and that he was not himself a 170-year-old stone house, its weight borne imperturbably by beams carved of oak, that he was something more transitory and mysterious. It wasn't this house she hated, anyway. What she hated were memories she couldn't shake loose from, all of them associated with the house, memories that, of course, he shared. Mary, as a grade school kid, lying on the floor of the study next to Dawn's desk, drawing pictures of Count while Dawn did the accounts for the farm. Mary emulating her mother's concentration, enjoying working with the same discipline, silently delighting to feel an equal in a common pursuit, and in some preliminary way offering them a glimpse of herself as the adult. Yes, of the adult friend to them that she would someday be. Memories particularly of when they weren't being what parents are 9/10 of the time. The taskmasters, the examples, the moral authorities, the nags of, pick that up and you're going to be late, keepers of the diary of her duties and routines. Memories, rather, of when they found one another afresh, beyond the tensions between parental mastery and inept childish uncertainty, of those moments of respite in a family's life when they could reach one another in calm. The early mornings in the bathroom, shaving while Dawn went to wake Mary up, he couldn't imagine a better start to the morning than catching a glimpse of that ritual. There was never an alarm clock in Mary's life. Dawn was her alarm clock. Before 6 o'clock, Dawn was already out in the barn, but at promptly 6:30, she stopped tending the herd, came back in the house, and went up to the child's room where, as she sat at the edge of the bed, daybreak's comforting observance began. Without a word, it began, Dawn simply stroking Mary's sleeping head, a pantomime that could go on for 2 full minutes. Next, almost singing the whispered words, Dawn lightly inquired, "A sign of life?" Mary responded not by opening her eyes, but by moving a little finger. "Another sign, please." On the game went, Mary playing along by wrinkling her nose, by moistening her lips, by sighing just audibly till eventually she was up, out of bed, ready to go. It was a game embodying a loss. For Mary, the state of being completely protected. For Dawn, the project of completely protecting what once had seemed completely protectable. Waking the baby. It continued until the baby was nearly 12. The one rite of infancy that Dawn couldn't resist indulging, that neither one of them ever appeared eager to outgrow. How he loved to sight them doing together what mothers and daughters do. To a father's eye, one seemed to amplify the other. In bathing suits, rushing out of the surf together and racing each other to the towels, the wife, now a little past her robust moment, and the daughter edging up to the beginning of hers. A delineation of life's cyclical nature that left him feeling afterwards as though he had a spacious understanding of the whole female sex. Mary, with a growing curiosity about the trappings of womanhood, putting on Dawn's jewelry while beside her at the mirror, Dawn helped her preen. Mary confiding in Dawn about her fears of ostracism, of other kids ignoring her, of her girlfriends ganging up on her. In those quiet moments from which she was excluded, daughter relying on mother, Dawn and Mary emotionally one inside the other like those Russian dolls. Mary appeared more poignantly than ever, not a small replica of his wife or of himself, but an independent little being, something similar, a version of them, yet distinctive and new, for which he had the most passionate affinity. It wasn't the house Dawn hated. What she hated, he knew, was that the motive for having the house, for making the beds, for setting the table, for laundering the curtains, for organizing the holidays, for apportioning her energies and differentiating her duties by the day of the week, had been destroyed right along with Hamlin's store. The tangible daily fullness, the smooth regularity that was once the underpinning of all of their lives survived in her only as an illusion, as a mockingly inaccessible, bigger-than-life-size fantasy, real for every last old Rimrock family but hers. He knew this not just because of the million memories, but also because, in the top drawer of his office desk, he still kept handy a 10-year-old copy of a local weekly, the Denville Randolph Courier, featuring on the first page the article about Dawn and her cattle business. She had consented to be interviewed only if the journalist promised not to mention her having been Miss New Jersey of 1949. The journalist agreed, and the piece was titled, "Old Rimrock Woman Feels Lucky to Love What She's Doing," and concluded with a paragraph that, simple as it was, made him proud of her whenever he went back to read it. "People are lucky if they get to do what they love and are good at it," Mrs. Lvov declared. The Courier story testified just how much she had loved the house, as well as everything else about their lives. Beneath the photograph of her standing before the pewter plates lined up on the fireplace mantel, in her white turtleneck shirt and cream-colored blazer, with her hair styled in a page boy and her two delicate hands in front of her, the fingers decorously intertwined, looking sweet, though a bit plain, the caption read, "Mrs. Lvov, the former Miss New Jersey of 1949, loves living in a 170-year-old home, an environment which she says reflects the values of her family." When Dawn called the paper in a fury about mentioning Miss New Jersey, the journalist answered that he had kept to his promise not to mention it in the article. It was the editor who had put it in the caption. No, she hadn't hated the house. Of course she hadn't. And that didn't matter anyway. All that mattered now was the restoration of her well-being. The foolish remarks she might make to this one or that one were of no consequence besides the recovery taking hold. Maybe what was agitating him was that the self-adjustments on which he was building a recovery were not regenerative for him or entirely admirable to him, or even something of an affront to him. He couldn't tell people, certainly couldn't convince himself, that he hated the things he'd loved. He was back to it. But he couldn't help it. Not when he remembered how at 7, Mary would eat herself sick with the raw batter while baking 2 dozen Toll House cookies. And a week later, they'd still be finding batter all over the place, even up on top of the refrigerator. So how could he hate the refrigerator? How could he let his emotions be reshaped, imagine himself being rescued, as Dawn did, by their leaving it behind for an all-but-silent new ice temp, the Rolls-Royce of refrigerators? He, for one, could not say he hated the kitchen in which Mary used to bake her cookies and melt her cheese sandwiches and make her bake ziti, even if the cupboards weren't stainless steel or the Countess Italian marble. He could not say he hated the cellar where she used to go to play hide-and-seek with her screaming friends, even if sometimes it spooked him a little to be down there in the wintertime with those scuttling mice. He could not say he hated the massive fireplace adorned with the antique iron kettle that was all at once insufferably corny in Dawn's estimation. Not when he remembered how early every January he would chop up the Christmas tree and set it afire there, the whole thing in one go, so that the explosive blaze of the bone-dry branches, the great whoosh, and the loud crackling and the dancing shadows, cavorting devils climbing to the ceiling from the four walls, would transport Mary into a delirium of terrified delight. He could not say he hated the ball and clawfoot bathtub where he used to give her baths, just because decades of indelible mineral stains from the well water streaked the enamel and encircled the drain. He could not even hate the toilet. whose handle required all that jiggling to get the thing to stop gushing. Not when he remembered her kneeling beside it and throwing up while he knelt next to her, holding her sick little forehead. Nor could he say he hated his daughter for what she had done. If he could, if only, instead of living chaotically in the world where she wasn't, and in the world where she once was, and in the world where she might now be, he could come to hate her enough not to care anything about her world, then or now. If only he could be back thinking like everybody else, once again the totally natural man instead of this riven charlatan of sincerity, an artless outer Swede and a tormented inner Swede, a visible stable Swede and a concealed beleaguered Swede, an easygoing, smiling, sham Swede enshrouding the Swede buried alive. If only he could even faintly reconstitute the undivided oneness of existence that had made for his straightforward physical confidence and freedom before he became the father of an alleged murderer. If only he could be as unknowing as some people perceived him to be. If only he could be as perfectly simple as the legend of Swede Lvov concocted by the hero-worshipping kids of his day. If only he could say, "I hate this house," and be weak-wake Swede Lvov again. If he could say, "I hate that child, I never want to see her again," and then go ahead, disown her, forevermore despise and reject her and the vision for which she was willing, if not to kill, then to cruelly abandon her own family. A vision having nothing whatsoever to do with ideals, but with dishonesty, criminality, megalomania, and insanity. Blind antagonism and an infantile desire to menace, those were her ideals, in search always of something to hate. Yes, it went way, way beyond his stuttering. That violent hatred of America was a disease unto itself, and he loved America. Loved being an American. But back then, he hadn't dared begin to explain to her why he did, for fear of unleashing the demon insult. They lived in dread of Mary's stuttering tongue. And by then, he had no influence anyway. Dawn had no influence. His parents had no influence. In what way was she his any longer if she hadn't been his then? Certainly not his, if to drive her into her frightening blitzkrieg mentality it required no more than for her own father to begin to explain why his affections happened to be for the country where he'd been born and raised. Stuttering, sputtering little bitch, who the fuck did she think she was? Imagine the vileness with which she would have assaulted him for revealing to her that just reciting the names of the 48 states used to thrill him back when he was a little kid. The truth of it was, even the road maps used to give him a kick when they gave them away free at the gas station. So the offhand way he'd got his nickname. The first day of high school, down in the gym for their first class, and him just jerking around with the basketball while the other kids were still all over the place getting into their sneakers. From 15 feet out, he dropped in two hook shots, swish, swish, just to get started. And then, that easygoing way that Henry, Doc Ward, the popular young phys ed teacher and wrestling coach fresh from Montclair State, laughingly called from his office doorway, called out to the lanky blonde 14-year-old with the brilliant blue gaze and the easy, effortless style whom he'd never seen in his gym before. "Where'd you learn that, Swede?" Because the name differentiated Seymour Lvov from Seymour Munzer and Seymour Wishnow, who were also on the class roll, it stuck all through gym his freshman year. Then other teachers and coaches took it up, then the kids in the school, and afterwards, as long as Weequahic remained the old Jewish Weequahic and people there still cared about the past, Doc Ward was known as the guy who christened Swede Lvov. It just stuck, simple as that. An old American nickname proclaimed by a gym teacher bequeathed in a gym, a name that made him mythic in a way that Seymour would never have done, mythic not only during his high school years, but to his schoolmates in memory for the rest of their days. He carried it with him like an invisible passport, all the while wandering deeper and deeper into an American's life, forthrightly evolving into a large, smooth, optimistic American, such as his conspicuously raw forebears, including the obstinate father whose American claim was not inconsiderable, couldn't have dreamed of as one of their own. The way his father talked to people, that got him too. The American, where his father said to the guy at the pump, "Fill her up, Mac." Check the front end, will you, Chief? The excitement of their trips into DeSoto. The tiny, musty tourist cabins they stopped at overnight while meandering up through the scenic back roads of New York State to see Niagara Falls. The trip to Washington when Jerry was a brat all the way. His first Liberty home from the Marines. The pilgrimage to Hyde Park with the folks and Jerry to stand together as a family looking at FDR's grave. Fresh from boot camp and there at Roosevelt's grave, he felt that something meaningful was happening. Hardened and richly tanned from training through the hottest months on a parade ground where the temperature rose some days to 120 degrees, he stood silent, proudly wearing his new summer uniform. The shirt starched, the khaki pants sleekly pocketless over the rear and perfectly pressed, the tie pulled taut, cap scented on his close-shaven head, black leather dress shoes spit-shined a gleam, and the belt? The belt that made him feel most like a Marine, that tightly woven khaki fabric belt with a metal buckle, girding a waist that had seen him through some 10,000 sit-ups as a raw Paris Island recruit. Who was she to sneer at all this, to reject all this, to hate all this and set out to destroy it? The war, winning the war, did she hate that too? The neighbors out in the street crying and hugging on BJ Day, blowing car horns and marching up and down front lawns, loudly banging kitchen pots. He was still at Paris Island then, but his mother had described it to him in a 3-page letter. The celebration party at the playground back of the school that night, everyone they knew. Family friends, school friends, the neighborhood butcher, the grocer, the pharmacist, the tailor, even the bookie from the candy store. All in ecstasy, long lines of staid, middle-aged people madly mimicking Carmen Miranda and dancing the conga. 1, 2, 3, kick. 1, 2, 3, kick. Until after 2 a.m. The war. Winning that war. Victory, victory, victory had come. No more death and war. His last months of high school, he'd read the paper every night, following the Marines across the Pacific. He saw the photographs in life, photographs that haunted his sleep, of the crumpled bodies of dead Marines killed on Peleliu, an island in the chain called the Palaus. At a place called Bloody Nose Ridge, Japs ferreted in old phosphate mines, who were themselves to be burned to a crisp by the flamethrowers, had cut down hundreds and hundreds of young Marines, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, boys barely older than he was. He had a map up in his room with pins sticking out of it, pins he had inserted to mark where the Marines, closing in on Japan, had assaulted from the sea a tiny atoll or an island chain where the Japs dug into coral fortresses, poured forth ferocious mortar and rifle fire. Okinawa was invaded on April 1, 1945, Easter Sunday of his senior year, and just 2 days after he'd hit a double and a home run in a losing game against Westside. The 6th Marine Division overran Yontan, one of 2 island air bases within 3 hours of wading ashore. Took the Motobu Peninsula in 13 days just off the Okinawa beach. 2 kamikaze pilots attacked the flagship carrier Bunker Hill on May 14th, the day after the Swede went 4-for-4 against Irvington High, a single, a triple, and 2 doubles, plunging their planes, packed with bombs, into the flight deck jammed with American planes all gassed up to take off and laden with ammunition. The blaze climbed 1,000 feet into the sky, and in the explosive firestorm that raged for 8 hours, 400 sailors and aviators died. Marines of the 6th Division captured Sugarloaf Hill May 14, 1945. 3 more doubles for the Swede in a winning game against Eastside. Maybe the worst, most savage single day of fighting in Marine history. Maybe the worst in human history. The caves and tunnels that honeycombed Sugarloaf Hill at the southern end of the island, where the Japs had fortified and hidden their army, were blasted with flamethrowers and then sealed with grenades and demolition charges. Hand-to-hand fighting went on day and night. Jap riflemen and machine gunners, chained to their positions and unable to retreat, fought until they died. The day the Swede graduated from Wickwayock High, June 22nd, having racked up the record number of doubles in a single season by a Newark City League player, the 6th Marine Division raised the American flag over Okinawa's 2nd Air Base, Kadena, and the final staging area for the invasion of Japan was secured. From April 1, 1945 to June 21, 1945, coinciding, give or take a few days, with the Swedes' last and best season as a high school first baseman, an island some 50 miles long and about 10 miles wide had been occupied by American forces at the cost of 15,000 American lives. The Japanese dead, military and civilian, numbered 141,000. To conquer the Japanese homeland to the north and end the war meant the number of dead on each side could run 10, 20, 30 times as great. And still the Swede went out and, to be part of the final assault on Japan, joined the U.S. Marines, who on Okinawa, as on Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Guam, and Guadalcanal, had absorbed casualties that were stupefying. The Marines. Being a Marine boot camp. Knocked us around every which way, called us all kinds of names, physically and mentally murdered us for 3 months, and it was the best experience I ever had in my life. Took it on as a challenge, and I did it. My name became EO. That's the way the Southern drill instructors pronounced Lvov. Dropping the L and the two V's, all consonants overboard, and lengthening out the two vowels. EO. Like a donkey brain. EO.
Yes, sir.
Major Dunleavy, the athletic director, big guy, Purdue football coach, stops the platoon one day, and the hefty sergeant we call Seabag shouts for Private EO. And out I run with my helmet on, and my heart was pounding because I thought my mother had died. I was just a week away from being assigned to Camp Lejeune up in North Carolina for advanced weaponry training, but Major Dunleavy pulled the plug on that, and so I never got to fire a bar. And that was why I joined the Marines. Wanted more than anything to fire the bar from flat on my belly with the barrel elevated on a mount. 18 years old, and that was the Marine Corps to me. The rapid-firing, air-cooled, 30-caliber machine gun. What a patriotic kid that innocent kid was. Wanted to fire the tank killer, the handheld bazooka rocket. Wanted to prove to myself I wasn't scared and could do that stuff. Grenades, flamethrowers, crawling under barbed wire, blowing up bunkers, attacking caves. Wanted to hit the beach in a duck. Wanted to help win the war. But Major Dunleavy had got a letter from his friend in Newark. What an athlete this Lvov was. Glowing letter about how wonderful I was, and so they reassigned me and made me a drill instructor to keep me on the island to play ball. By then, they dropped the atomic bomb, and the war was over anyway. You're in my unit, Swede. Glad to have you. A great break, really. Once my hair grew in, I was a human being again. Instead of being called shithead all the time or shithead, move your ass, suddenly I was a DI the recruits called sir. What the DI called the recruits was you people. Hit the deck, you people. On your feet, you people. Double time, you people. Double time. Hup! Great. Great experience for a kid from Cure Avenue. Guys I would have never met in my life, accents from all over the place, the Midwest, New England, some farm boys from Texas and the Deep South, I couldn't even understand. But got to know them, got to like them. Hard boys, poor boys, lots of high school athletes, used to live with the boxers. Lived with the recreation gang, another Jewish guy, Manny Rabinowitz from Altoona. Toughest Jewish guy I ever met in my life, what a fighter. Great friend. Didn't even finish high school. Never had a friend like that, before or since. Never laughed so hard in my life as I did with Manny. Manny was money in the bank for me. Nobody ever gave us any Jew boy shit. A little back in boot camp, but that was it. When Manny fought, the guys would bet their cigarettes on him. Buddy Falcone and Manny Rabinowitz were always the two winners for us whenever we fought another base. After the fight with Manny, the other guy would say that nobody had ever hit him as hard in his life. Manny ran the entertainment with me, the boxing smokers, the duo, the Jewish leathernecks. Manny got the wise guy recruit who made all the trouble and weighed 145 pounds to fight somebody 160 pounds who he could be sure would beat the shit out of him. Always pick a redhead, EO, Manny said. He'll give you the best fight in the world. Redhead'll never quit. Manny, the scientist. Manny going up to Norfolk to fight a sailor, a middleweight contender before the war, and whipping him. Exercising the battalion before breakfast, marching the recruits down to the pool every night to teach them to swim. We practically threw them in. The old-fashioned way of teaching swimming, but you had to swim to be a Marine. Always had to be ready to do 10 more push-ups than any of the recruits. They challenged me, but I was in shape. Getting on the bus, going to play ball, the long distances we flew, huh? Bob Collins on the team, the big St. John's guy, my teammate, terrific athlete. Boozer, with Bob C., got drunk for the first time in my life. Talked for 2 hours nonstop about playing ball for Week Wake and then threw up all over the deck. Irish guys, Italian guys, Slovaks.
Poles, tough little bastards from Pennsylvania. Kids who'd run away from fathers who worked in the mines and beat them with belt buckles and with their fists. These were the guys I lived with and ate with and slept alongside. Even an Indian guy, a Cherokee, a third baseman. Called him Piss Cutter, the same as the name for our caps. Don't ask me why. Not all of them decent people, but on the whole, all right, good guys. Lots of organized grab ass. Played against Fort Benning, Cherry Point, North Carolina, the Marine Air Base, beat them. Beat Charleston Navy Yard. We had a couple of boys who could throw the ball. One pitcher went on to the Tigers, went down to Rome, Georgia to play ball, over to Waycross, Georgia to an Army base. Called the Army guys doggies. Beat them. Beat everybody. Saw the South. Saw things I never saw. Saw the life the Negroes live. Met every kind of Gentile you can think of. Met beautiful Southern girls. Met common whores, used a condom, skinned her back and squeezed her down. Saw Savannah, saw New Orleans. Sat in a run-down slop chute in Mobile, Alabama, where I was damn glad the shore patrol was just outside the door. Playing basketball and baseball with the 22nd Regiment. Got to be a United States Marine. Got to wear the emblem with the anchor and the globe. No pitcher in there, EO. Poke it out of here, EO. Got to be EO to guys from Maine, New Hampshire, Louisiana, Virginia, Mississippi, Ohio. Guys without an education from all over America calling me EO. And nothing more. Just plain EO to them. Love that. Discharged, June 2nd, 1947. Got to marry a beautiful girl named Dwyer. Got to run a business my father built, a man whose own father couldn't speak English. Got to live in the prettiest spot in the world. Hate America? Why, he lived in America the way he lived inside his own skin. All the pleasures of his younger years were American pleasures. All that success and happiness had been American. And he need no longer keep his mouth shut about it just to diffuse her ignorant hatred. The loneliness he would feel as a man without all his American feelings. The longing he would feel if he had to live in another country. Yes, everything that gave meaning to his accomplishments had been American. Everything he loved was here. For her, being an American was loathing America. But loving America was something he could not let go of any more than he could have let go of loving his father and his mother. Any more than he could let go of his decency. How could she hate this country when she had no conception of this country? How could a child of his be so blind as to revile the rotten system that had given her own family every opportunity to succeed? To revile her capitalist parents as though their wealth were the product of anything other than the unstinting industry of three generations? The men of three generations, including even himself, slogging through the slime and stink of a tannery? The family that started out in a tannery, at one with, side by side with, the lowest of the low, now to her, capitalist dogs? There wasn't much difference, and she knew it, between hating America and hating them. He loved the America she hated and blamed for everything that was imperfect in life, and wanted violently to overturn. He loved the bourgeois value she hated and ridiculed and wanted to subvert. He loved the mother she hated and had all but murdered by doing what she did. Ignorant little fucking bitch. The price they had paid. Why shouldn't he tear up this Rita Cohen letter? Rita Cohen. They were back. The sadistic mischief makers with their bottomless talent for antagonism who had extorted the money from him. Who, for the fun of it, had extracted from him the Audrey Hepburn scrapbook, the stuttering diary, and the ballet shoes. These delinquent young brutes calling themselves revolutionaries, who had so viciously played with his hopes 5 years back, had decided the time had again rolled around to laugh at sweet Lvov. We can only stand as witnesses to the anguish that sanctifies her, the disciple who calls herself Rita Cohen. They were laughing at him. They had to be laughing. Because the only thing worse than it's all being a wicked joke was it's not being a wicked joke. Your daughter is divine? My daughter is anything and everything but. She's all too frail and misguided and wounded. She's hopeless. Why did you tell her that you slept with me? And tell me that it was she who wanted you to? You say these things because you hate us. And you hate us because we don't do such things. You hate us not because we're reckless, but because we're prudent and sane and industrious and agree to abide by the law. You hate us because we haven't failed, because we've worked hard and honestly to become the best in the business, and because of that, we've prospered. So you envy us, and you hate us, and want to destroy us, and so you used her, a 16-year-old kid with a stutter. No, nothing small about you people. Made her into a revolutionary full of great thoughts and high-minded ideals. Sons of bitches. You enjoy the spectacle of our devastation. Cowardly bastards. It isn't cliches that enslaved her. It's you who enslaved her in the loftiest of the shallow cliches. And that resentful kid, with a stutterous hatred of injustice, had no protection at all. You got her to believe she was at one with the downtrodden people and made her into your patsy, your stooge. And Dr. Fred Conlon, as a result, is dead. That was who you killed to stop the war. The chief of staff up at the hospital in Dover. The guy who, in a small community hospital, established a coronary care unit of 8 beds. That was his crime. Instead of exploding in the middle of the night when the village was empty, the bomb, either as planned or by mistake, went off at 5 a.m., an hour before Hamlin's store opened for the day, and the moment that Fred Conlon turned away from having dropped into the mailbox envelopes containing checks for household bills that he paid at his desk the evening before. He was on his way to the hospital. A chunk of metal flying out of the store struck him at the back of the skull. Dawn was under sedation and couldn't see anyone, but the suite had gone to Russ and Mary Hamlin's house and expressed his sympathy about the store. Told the Hamlins how much the store had meant to Dawn and him, how it was no less a part of their lives than it was of everyone else's in the community. Then he went to the wake. In the coffin, Conlon looked fine, fit, just as affable as ever. And the following week, with their doctor already arranging for Dawn's hospitalization, the Swede went alone to visit Conlon's widow. How he managed to get to that woman's house for tea is another story, another book, but he did it. He did it. And heroically, she served him tea while he extended his family's condolences in the words that he had revised in his mind 500 times, but that, when spoken, was still no good, even more hollow than those he uttered to Russ and Mary Hamlin. Deep and sincere regrets, the agony of your family, my wife would like you to know. After listening to everything he had to say, Mrs. Conlon quietly replied, displaying an outlook so calm and kind and compassionate that the Swede wanted to disappear, to hide like a child, while at the same time the urge was nearly overpowering to throw himself at her feet and to remain there forever, begging for her forgiveness. "You are good parents, and you raised your daughter the way you thought best," she said to him. "It wasn't your fault, and I don't hold anything against you. You didn't go out and buy the dynamite. You didn't make the bomb. You didn't plant the bomb. You had nothing to do with the bomb. If, as it appears, your daughter turns out to be the one who's responsible, I'll hold no one responsible but her. I feel badly for you and your family, Mr. Lvov. I've lost a husband. My children have lost a father. But you have lost something even greater. You are parents who have lost a child. There's not a day that goes by that you won't be in my thoughts and in my prayers." The Swede had known Fred Conlon only slightly, from cocktail parties and charity events where they found themselves equally bored. Mainly, he knew him by reputation, a man who cared about his family and the hospital with the same devotion, a hard worker, good guy. Under him, the hospital had begun to plan a building program, the first since its construction, and in addition to the new coronary care unit, during his stewardship, there had been a long overdue modernization of emergency room facilities. But who gives a shit about the emergency room of a community hospital out in the sticks? Who gives a shit about a rural general store whose owner had been running it since 1921? We're talking about humanity. When has there ever been progress for humanity without a few small mishaps and mistakes? The people are angry, and they have spoken. Violence will be met by violence, regardless of consequences, until the people are liberated. Fascist America down, one post office, facility completely destroyed. Except, as it happened, Hamlin's was not an official U.S. post office, nor were the Hamlin's U.S. postal employees. Theirs was merely a postal station, contracted for X number of dollars to handle a little postal business on the side. Hamlin's was no more a government installation than the office where your accountant makes out your tax forms. But that's a mere technicality to world revolutionaries. Facility destroyed. 1,100 old Rimrock residents forced for a full year and a half to drive 5 miles to buy their stamps and to get packages weighed and to send anything registered or special delivery. That'll show Lyndon Johnson who's boss. They were laughing at him. Life was laughing at him. Mrs. Conlon had said, "You're as much the victims of this tragedy as we are. The difference is that for us, though recovery will take time, we will survive as a family. We will survive as a loving family. We will survive with our memories intact and with our memories to sustain us. It will not be any easier for us than it will be for you to make sense of something so senseless. But we are the same family we were when Fred was here, and we will survive." The clarity and force with which he implied that the Swede and his family would not survive made him wonder, in the weeks that followed, if her kindness and her compassion was so all-encompassing as he had wanted at first to believe. He never went to see her again. He told his secretary that he was going over to New York, to the Czech mission, where he'd already had preliminary discussions about a trip to Czechoslovakia later in the fall. In New York, he had examined specimen gloves as well as shoes, belts, pocketbooks, and wallets manufactured in Czechoslovakia. And now the Czechs were working up plans for him to visit factories in Brno and Bratislava, so he could see the glove set up firsthand and examine a more extensive sample of their work while it was in production and when it came off the floor. There was no longer any question that in Czechoslovakia, leather apparel could be more cheaply made than in Newark or Puerto Rico, and probably better made, too. The workmanship that had begun falling off in the Newark plant since the riots had continued to deteriorate, especially once Vicky retired as making room forelady. Even granting that what he'd seen at the Czech mission might not be representative of day-to-day production, it had been impressive enough. Back in the 30s, the Czechs had flooded the American market with fine gloves. Over the years, excellent Czech cutters had been employed by Newark Made, and the machinist, who for 30 years had been employed full-time tending Newark Made sewing machines, keeping those workhorses running, replacing worn-out shafts, levers, throat plates, bobbins, endlessly adjusting each machine's timing and tension, was a Czech. A wonderful worker, expert with every glove machine on earth, able to fix anything. Even though the Swede had assured his father he had no intention of signing over any aspect of their operation to a communist government until he returned with a thorough report, he was confident that pulling out of Newark wasn't far down the line. Dawn, by this time, had her new face and had begun the startling comeback. And as for Mary, well, Mary dear, Mary darling, my precious one and only Mary child, how can I possibly remain on Central Avenue struggling to keep my production up, taking the beating we're taking there from black people who care nothing any longer about the quality of my product, people who are careless, people who got me over a barrel because they know there's nobody trainable left in Newark to replace them, for fear that if I leave Central Avenue, you will call me a racist and never see me again? I have waited so long to see you again. Your mother has waited. Grandpa and Grandma have waited. We've all been waiting 24 hours a day, every day of every year, for 5 years to see you, or to hear from you, or somehow to get some word of you, and we can postpone our lives no longer. It's 1973, mother is a new woman. If we are ever again going to live, now is when we must begin. Nonetheless, he was waiting not for the pleasant consul at the Czech mission to welcome him with a glass of Slivovitz, as his father or his wife would think if they happened to phone the office, but across from the Dog and Cat Hospital on New Jersey Railroad Avenue, a 10-minute car ride from the Newark Made factory. 10 minutes away, and for years? In Newark for years? Mary was living in the one place in the world he would never have guessed had he been given 1,000 guesses. Was he deficient in intelligence, or was she so provocative, so perverse, so insane he still could not imagine anything she might do? Was he deficient also in imagination? What father wouldn't be? It was preposterous. His daughter was living in Newark, working across the Pennsylvania railroad tracks, and not at the end of the Ironbound, where the Portuguese were reclaiming the poor down-neck streets, but here, at the Ironbound's westernmost edge, in the shadow of the railroad viaduct that closed off Railroad Avenue all along the western side of the street. That grim fortification was the city's Chinese Wall. Brownstone boulders piled 20 feet high, strung out for more than a mile, and intersected only by a half a dozen foul underpasses. Along this forsaken street, as ominous now as any street in any ruined city in America, was a reptilian length of unguarded wall, barren even of graffiti. But for the wilted weeds that managed to jut forth in wiry clumps where the mortar was cracked and washed away, the viaduct wall was barren of everything except the affirmation of a weary industrial city's prolonged and triumphant struggle to monumentalize its ugliness. On the east side of the street, the dark old factories, Civil War factories, foundries, brassworks, heavy industrial plants blackened from chimneys pumping smoke for 100 years, were windowless now. The sunlight sealed out with brick and mortar, their exits and entrances plugged with cinder block. These were the factories where people had lost fingers and arms and got their feet crushed and their faces scalded, where children once labored in the heat and the cold. The 19th century factories that churned up people and churned out goods and now were unpierceable, airtight tombs. It was Newark that was entombed there, a city that was not going to stir again. The pyramids of Newark, as huge and dark and hideously impermeable as a great dynasty's burial edifice has every historical right to be. The rioters hadn't crossed beneath the elevated railroad tracks. If they had, these factories, the whole block of them, would be burned out rubble like the West Market Street factories back of Newark made. His father used to tell him, brownstone and brick, there was the business. Brownstone quarried right here. Know that? Out by Belleville, north, along the river. This city's got everything. What a business that must have been. The guy who sold Newark brownstone and brick, he was sitting pretty. On Saturday mornings, the Swede would drive down Neck alongside his father to pick up the week's finished gloves from the Italian families paid to do piecework in their homes. As the car bounced along the streets paved with bricks, past one poor little frame house after another, the massive railroad viaduct remained brokenly within view. It would not go away. This was the Swede's first encounter with the man-made sublime that divides and dwarfs. And in the beginning, it was frightening to him. A child susceptible to his environment, even then, with a proclivity to be embraced by it and to embrace it in return. 6 or 7 years old, maybe 5, maybe Jerry hadn't even been born yet, the dwarfing stones causing the city to be even more gigantic for him than it already was. The man-made horizon, the brutal cut in the body of the giant city, it felt as though they were entering the shadow world of hell, when all the boy was seeing was the railroad's answer to the populist crusade to hoist the tracks above the grade crossings so as to end the crashes and the pedestrian carnage. Brownstone and brick, said his father admiringly. There was a guy whose worries were over. That had all taken place before they moved to Keir Avenue, when they were living across from the synagogue in a three-family house at the poor end of Wainwright Street. His father didn't even have a loft then, but got his skins from a fellow who was also down-neck and who trafficked out of his garage and whatever the workers could carry from the tanneries, hidden within their big rubber boots or wrapped around them beneath their overalls. The hide man was himself a tannery worker, a big, gruff pole with tattoos up and down his massive arms, and the Swede had vague memories of his father standing at the garage's one window, holding the finished hides up to the light and searching them for defects, then stretching them over his knee before making his selection. "Feel this," he'd say to the Swede once they were safely back in the car, and the child would crease a delicate kid's skin as he'd seen his father do, finger the fineness appreciatively, the velvet texture of the skin's close, tight grain. "That's leather," his father told him. "What makes kid's skin so delicate, Seymour?" "I don't know,"
Well, what is a kid?
A baby goat.
Right. And what does he eat?
Milk?
Right.
And because all the animal has eaten is milk, that's what makes the grain smooth and beautiful.